From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The White House is unveiling a plan today that will address the surge in gun violence plaguing American cities. President Biden is promising to crack down on illegal gun sales and boost funding for community anti-violence programs. And later today, Attorney General Merrick Garland will meet with local officials that are trying to solve the problem. That includes Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott, a Democrat. He joins me now en route to the White House. Mayor, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back on the show.
So the Biden administration points out that homicides in big cities were up 30% last year, and I know you've seen a spike there in Baltimore. What's your message to the White House today?
Well, the message is very clear that, one, we appreciate the White House understanding that this is a national public health issue in cities across the country, but and more importantly, that this White House is doing what hasn't been done before and thinking about the disease of gun violence far beyond, not just putting it at the burden of police, but understanding the need to have community-based and public health-based interventions into dealing with gun violence. And we have to. In cities across the country, have to, as a country, start to deal with the flow of illegal guns coming into our city.
Okay, well, the Baltimore Sun is reporting that your city has already had more than 160 homicides so far this year. That is up from last year. Do you have an explanation at all for why that's happening?
Well, it's actually a 6% increase versus last year, and we were the exception last year where we had a decrease and most major cities had. But we have to understand this. We know, for me, gun violence in Baltimore is why I ran for public office. I saw my first person get shot before I was 10 years old, and this disease has been plaguing my city for as long as I've been alive and even longer. But what we're seeing, we know that the pandemic and the hardships have forced people into things that they normally wouldn't do. We know now in our city that there are basic small conflict leading to people dying. We know that these illegal ghost guns are in our city at a much more higher rate than they were even last year. And we have to understand that the connectivity to all that are the guns and the inability for us as a nation really to deal with creating systems that get people out of poverty and dealing with trauma, dealing with behavioral and mental health too.
And we can hear that you're actually in the car right now speaking to us. You're on the way to Washington, D.C. to speak with the Biden administration. The White House says one of the plans it has to deal with this problem is to create a new strike force that would crack down on gun trafficking in five regions, including there where you are in the Washington, D.C. metro area. Do you think that will help stem the flow of illegal guns into your city, into Baltimore?
Absolutely. Listen, I met with our special agent in charge here 2 weeks ago, and we talked specifically about this. Baltimore, we became the first city to have what we're calling a firearms intelligence unit. We partner with every town for gun safety to develop a software for this unit of detectives that will work out of our office to go after these folks because we know 63% of the weapons we recovered in 2020 came from another state. And with the transportation issues that people in the neighborhoods that have the most violence face in Baltimore, we know they didn't go to Virginia or West Virginia or Florida or Georgia or North Carolina to purchase this gun. They're being trafficked into our city. We have a great working partnership with our ATF, and we're very excited about seeing that expand now because it will help us.
President Biden is also calling for more money for violence prevention programs, and specifically for the city of Baltimore. And I know this one hits close to home for you because many people in Baltimore are still grieving the loss of a man named Dante Barksdale, who led a program there called Safe Streets. He himself was shot and killed in January. Does that at all give you any pause about whether programs like that actually work and are the solution to this problem?
It does. It doesn't. And Dante was like a brother to me. It absolutely doesn't. It makes me want to go harder. And I said that when speaking about Dante right after he passed. He would want us to go harder and further. We know the program works, right? A neighborhood in Baltimore where we had a safe street site when I was a child wouldn't go a month without a shooting or a homicide. But Cherry Hill has gone not once, but twice, an entire year without having a homicide. And you've seen similar results in other neighborhoods, and that's why we have to expand the work of safe streets. Dante died doing what he did, trying to prevent someone from taking someone else's life. And we owe it to him to build upon his work and expand his work through the legacy of what we're trying to do, because we know it works. It's been proven to work. Women lie, men lie, numbers don't. The numbers say that safe streets work. And I'm thankful to the president and his administration for understanding that it's time for us to invest in this community-based violence interrupted work in a big way.
Brandon Scott is mayor of Baltimore. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
In the race for New York City mayor, Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams has taken the lead in this week's primary, with more than 80% of votes counted in what is the country's largest ever ranked choice election. But that is just the first step. Adams, who is a moderate, was the first choice for nearly a third of voters. Progressives Maya Wiley and Catherine Garcia came in second and third. So what does this mean and what is next? For that, we have Alyssa Katz. She's a deputy editor at The City, which covers New York City news and politics. Alyssa, welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Yes, well, there's a lot to talk about here. Tell us first about what we do know. We mentioned the three front runners, one moderate, two progressives. Tell us briefly about them.
Sure. So right now in the lead is Eric Adams, who is currently the Brooklyn Borough president, who had really run a very strong law and order campaign. So that approach certainly paid off for Adams. And then with a very different take on policing and what it means for communities is Maya Wiley, former attorney for Mayor Bill de Blasio, who had also chaired the what we call the Civilian Complaint Review Board, which deals with police discipline when members of the public have complaints about how they're being treated by the police, whether it's stop and frisk or improper use of force or other incidents. And she'd really come in with a message very much building on the post-George Floyd movement of really bringing more justice to communities. And then number three is Catherine Garcia, who's a former city official who's put herself out there as a can-do, let's get back to basics on government, make it work. And she really performed very, very well in Manhattan, where people are relatively wealthy, maybe not as immediately concerned about rising crime because while certainly some incidents take place in Manhattan, crime is just not as much of a day-to-day reality in some of the wealthier areas of the city. And under the ranked choice system, I mean, Adams definitely has an advantage going in. Wiley could catch up. And you know, it remains to be seen how people's lower ranked choices then get allocated among the top candidates in the counting.
Well, let's break that down a bit. Sticking with those three, what happens next as officials start counting second choices and adding it to these candidates' totals?
Sure. So, you know, keep in mind also, I should emphasize, we do not have absentee ballots yet, and those are playing more of a role than usual because New York has allowed universal absentee voting, which we didn't before because of the pandemic. So there's a lot we just simply don't know and will not know until those tallies begin, and they won't really begin probably until the end of this month or even well into July. What we'll be looking for is to see, like for voters who picked the candidates who underperformed, such as Andrew Yang, who conceded last night and is no longer in the running, voters who voted for him, who is their second choice? Who is their third choice? Because those second and third choice are going to be counted.
Right. And he had actually encouraged his supporters to choose Catherine Garcia as their second choice.
You know, I think what they were both doing is really trying to raise their profiles when it was very clear Eric Adams was dominating the headlines, really striking a nerve with a lower law and order message. Also, Adams benefited from super PAC spending, you know, outside money, some of which had come from billionaires. I think Garcia and Yang really wanted to maintain their visibility in the final days, and teaming up was one way to do that and sweep up votes. If one of them got eliminated, their votes could then go to the other candidate.
And as you said, the absentee ballots aren't due until June 29th. This, of course, is only the primary, so the winner will not be the next mayor. But many believe a Democrat will win this, which could mean the first woman mayor of New York City or the second black mayor, as you mentioned. Can you talk a little bit more about the significance of that?
Sure. I think it really is historic that the final four here are all women or people of color or both. And this is not a typical outcome in a New York City election where, with the exception of David Dinkins in the 1990s, you know, we've had entirely white men running the city forever. And I think that this is partly a result of a bunch of election reforms, not just ranked choice voting, but an enhanced public matching campaign finance system, new limits on donations from special interests, and other measures too. A lot of things that were meant to really tamp down the role of kind of big money, establishment power. The results we see really speak to the promised power of the reforms to really diversify who reasonably had a shot at leadership in New York City. And that's a very big development.
That's Alyssa Katz, deputy editor of The City in New York. Alyssa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The early onset of record heat this summer is causing havoc in many parts of the country. In a few minutes, we'll hear about how heat and drought is impacting water supplies and agriculture in California and Iowa. But first, we check in on Texas, where the state's aging electric grid is under pressure. So much so, the people there are being asked to conserve energy to avoid power cuts. You remember, millions lost power for days during February's deadly blackout. Katie Watkins of Houston Public Media reports.
Vita Salzman lost power for nearly 4 days at her Houston home during February's winter storm.
It got below freezing in the house. You know, you could see your breath.
Several pipes burst and the family's pet fish froze to death. Salzman, a mother of two, says because of what happened in February, she felt overwhelmed when the state grid operator warned of potential blackouts again due to the heat wave.
Here we are, second time this year, having to worry about how do I secure power to my home? How do I keep the living things inside my home alive in extreme weather? I can't believe we're having to discuss this the second time this year.
For 5 days last week, the state grid operator warned that power supply ran low. Residents were asked to conserve energy and set their thermostats to 78 degrees. Forecasters anticipate a hotter than average summer for Texas this year, and many are anxiously wondering how the grid is going to handle the coming months. Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner says he's frustrated with state legislators for not doing more to prevent power failures.
The leadership in Austin did not really address adequate reserve capacity. They didn't do that. And so now, even before we're getting to the summer, people across the state, not just in the Houston area, run the risk of rolling blackouts.
The heat wave brought higher than average temperatures for June, setting a record electricity demand as people cranked up their air conditioners. Supply was also tight as more thermal plants were offline than expected. The grid operator says it's looking into why that happened, though some experts point to aging infrastructure. Coal, gas, and nuclear make up the majority of the grid, and stagnant winds also meant wind turbines were producing less power. Still, by Texas summer standards, it wasn't that hot, not compared to August.
To see the grid conditions get so tight was really worrisome.
That's Dan Cohen, a professor at Rice University. He says he's concerned about the potential for rolling blackouts in July and August, especially if there's a major heat wave.
The fact that the grid was barely able to eke by and satisfy what we had a week ago doesn't bode well for how well it's going to hold up if we get, you know, 10 degrees hotter temperatures and correspondingly higher demand in August.
But Cohen says, unlike in February, when the cold damaged power plants that weren't winterized, any summer blackouts should theoretically be short-lived. It would come down to demand exceeding supply during the hottest part of the day, but stabilizing at night. Still, he says he's hopeful for the future as Texas is poised to see a large growth in solar in the next few years. For Here and Now, I'm Katie Watkins in Houston.
And I'm Steve Milne from CAP Radio in Sacramento. California is seeing record-setting hot temperatures earlier than usual this year. It's coinciding with the drought that is ravaging the state's reservoirs, making it harder for farmers to grow crops and for endangered fish species to survive. I spoke with Jeff McCormack, whose family has been farming on land along the Sacramento River Delta for 125 years.
We've been in business since 1896 and fourth generation. My son is the fifth.
The family grows 600 acres of pears, 50 acres of cherries, and about 90 acres of wine grapes. And since their property borders the Sacramento River, they have a right to that water. It's called riparian rights. Last week, McCormack was among more than 6,000 farmers in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta watershed who received letters from the state warning that they may be cut off from diverting river water to their crops.
If they cut us off, and of course our pears are going to suffer, and well, the grapes, everything's going to suffer. So yeah, this is a pretty scary.
The State Water Resources Control Board is telling farmers that water could be curtailed until winter rains come.
In the letter, they mentioned if you don't stop diverting, you will be subject to fines up to $1,000 a day per pump. We have 12 or 15 pumps.
The main reason farmers are facing curtailment is because the drought is depleting California's reservoirs, which feed into rivers, streams, and bays. Scientists say this year's drought is hotter and drier than previous ones. That means the water in California's reservoirs is evaporating faster.
It is quicker this year. Basically, we're seeing in the second year of this drought the same kind of low reservoir levels that we saw in the third year of the previous drought.
Jay Lund is with the Center for Watershed Sciences at UC Davis. He says the state's more than 1,500 reservoirs are 50% lower than they should be this time of year.
And it's warm, so we're going to see that the cold water behind those dams does not remain cold very far downstream, and that's going to be problematic for some of the salmon as well.
Salmon need cold water from the bottom of the reservoirs to spawn, and the San Francisco Bay needs fresh water from the reservoirs to keep out the salt water that harms freshwater fish. The water level at one key reservoir, Lake Oroville, could reach historic lows by late August. With no water from the reservoirs, the only water left for farmers is groundwater. Michael Smith grows fruits and vegetables at Spreadwing Farm in the Yolo County town of Rumsey. He says groundwater is not always the best for agricultural irrigation.
The quality of that water is really an issue for certain crops. So we've decided, for example, we're just not going to plant fall vegetables this year because we don't have the water to be able to irrigate it.
Smith says he's been thinking a lot about crops that are well adapted to the desert-like conditions California farmers are now finding themselves in.
So the figs and the pomegranates are doing great. I think olives do great. You know, there's probably other desert-adapted crops. I expect that farmers in this area are going to be reconsidering what it makes sense to grow.
For Here and Now, I'm Steve Milne in Sacramento.
Like California, intense heat has also brought about a drought in Iowa, along with low water levels. People there are also being asked to conserve water. Joining us now is Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters. Hi, Clay.
Hi, Tanya.
How widespread and severe is this drought in Iowa, and how does it compare to previous years?
Well, it is very dry, to say the least, and the driest it's been in almost a decade is what officials have been telling us. And it's affecting corn and soybean crops. Those are the two main crops that are grown in Iowa. Of course, we have a big livestock industry as well, but it's also putting a lot of stress on major urban areas. In Des Moines, the capital and the state's largest city, Des Moines Water Works is asking its 500,000 customers to cut back on their consumption, a cutback of lawn watering by 25%. And that's because one of the sources it gets its water from, the Raccoon River, is very low this year. They're in phase one of a four-phase water conservation plan, and they say they've only had to start implementing this thing one other time. To give you some kind of perspective overall in the state, about three-fourths of Iowa is either in what they classify moderate or severe drought. That's according to the latest national report from the U.S. Drought Monitor that came out last week. Now, we did get some rain over the weekend, and it was very welcome, but many officials across the state are saying, you know, it's not enough to right the ship at this point.
Oh, wow. There's so much here. The impact on crops this year, you've been talking with some folks in agriculture. What have they been telling you?
Yeah, of course, the rain that fell over the weekend has been welcome to those farmers. Farmers reported that the corn leaves have been curling and ground has been cracking in some areas of the state from the heat. The latest United States Department of Agriculture report shows that the corn condition is rated 56% good to excellent, and that's a drop of 7 percentage points from last week. Soybean emergence was 96% complete. That's 1 week ahead of the five-year average, and it's a 4% drop from the prior week. I talked with Joel DeYoung. He's a field agronomist with Iowa State University Extension. He's based in northwest Iowa, and that's where the drought is the most severe. And he's saying they've missed any of this rain in recent days, and it's a bigger pattern that they're seeing. He says where their Julys have been drier, springs and falls have been wetter. And he says right now farmers up there need the opposite. They need an above-average rainfall in July.
Although we've seen climate changes and rainfalls higher, the middle of summer in this part of the state in particular really has dropped. And so we add that long-term trend to the potential risk we have this year. That's increased the amount of angst that's out there as far as what's going to happen to our crop yields.
And so there is rain in the forecast in this coming week for much of Iowa. Joel DeYoung says it's kind of forecasted right now to miss his corner of the state. And altogether, it's just going to take a lot of rainfall to get where farmers feel comfortable. I mean, the soil in Iowa is great soil for growing things like corn and soybeans, the way that it's managed at holding that moisture. But there just isn't enough in its reserve in the soil this year. And the dryness is really impacting that right now.
Oh, Clay, we're just at the start of summer. On the issue of the water levels, what is the plan if levels don't improve?
Well, certainly in the urban areas, like I mentioned, Des Moines, their concern is just water rationing. They hope that they don't have to get there. They're remaining cautiously optimistic that consumers will cut back on lawn watering. For farmers, you know, certainly they have crop insurance that pays them out if they don't get the kind of yields. It's kind of a backup system there that they get paid for the product that they're putting out in their field so they can keep farming. You might remember last year's farmers were affected here by that derecho, kind of an inland hurricane that happened in August with straight line winds. That affected their bottom line. And so, I mean, it has been a challenge for farmers to overcome in recent years. But now we've got this new challenge with the drought that we haven't seen in almost a decade. And they're just hoping for some rain to come.
Clay Masters of Iowa Public Radio. Thank you so much, Clay.
You're welcome.
What happens after a police officer shoots someone who's unarmed? For decades in California, internal affairs investigations, how the police themselves, were secret. Until now. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
The Supreme Court handed a victory today to a young cheerleader from Pennsylvania and to advocates for free speech. In an 8-1 decision, the court sided with a high school student who was punished by her school for posting a vulgar message on Snapchat. She was suspended from the cheer team for a year. NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson joins us now by Skype. Carrie, welcome.
Happy to be here.
So this case was about Brandi Levy and this social media post that she sent when she was away from school grounds. Remind us what happened.
Brandi Levy had tried out for the varsity cheerleading squad in her high school in Pennsylvania, but she didn't make it. She got really frustrated, and she wound up sending two vulgar messages on Snapchat from a convenience store, not from school grounds. One of the messages contained words like F cheer, F school, F everything. Those messages got around, and the school suspended her from cheerleading for the upcoming year, and Brandi Levy sued.
And what'd the court think about it?
Well, in a majority opinion by Justice Stephen Breyer, the high court ruled that schools can police some off-campus speech by students, giving an opening for things like policing bullying and harassment off-campus. But the court majority found the school here in Pennsylvania was out of line, that it went too far. that there wasn't a substantial disruption in school because of those Snapchat messages Brandi Levy sent. Now, a few cheerleaders were upset. There was a discussion about it in algebra class. But the court ruled that's not enough to justify infringing First Amendment rights of students. And the court found America's public schools are nurseries of democracy.
Well, Justice Clarence Thomas was the lone dissenter here in this case. What did we hear from him?
Yeah, his dissent went all the way back to history, schools and education practices and discipline dating back to the 19th century. Clarence Thomas is far less tolerant of vulgarity and remarks by students, but importantly, no other justice joined his dissent.
Carrie, the issue of how schools police student speech online away from school is actually very important given how much time kids these days are spending on their devices. What are the larger implications of this case?
Yeah, hugely important. And the court majority here avoided making a broad pronouncement about what exactly counts as off-campus speech, especially the majority opinion said at a time when we've just been experimenting with online learning during the pandemic. First Amendment advocates at the American Civil Liberties Union are still counting this as a big win, though, Peter. And Brandi Levy, who's now a freshman in college, said today in a statement that the school went too far. She's glad the Supreme Court agrees. She said young people need to have the ability to express themselves without worrying about being punished when they get to school.
Less than a minute here to go, but we got another ruling from the court today, one that said police cannot always enter someone's home without a warrant, even when they're pursuing a person for a minor crime. Just briefly, what's the headline there?
Yeah, the court ruled that it may not always be justified for cops to enter a home without a warrant if it's a minor crime, such as noisemaking and other situations like that. This was not a hot pursuit, this particular case, which involved playing the radio really loud on a deserted highway.
NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson, thank you very much.
Happy to be here.
Members of Venezuela's opposition are in Washington, D.C. this week to meet with the Biden administration. They're trying to figure out a pathway to remove sanctions they say have crippled the country's economy. Venezuela has experienced over the years one of the largest mass migrations in the world. Millions of Venezuelans have fled because there just isn't enough food, fuel, or medicine. And now it's dealing with another crisis, the shortage of vaccines for COVID-19. Eric Schatzker of Bloomberg Television saw this firsthand.
There's an enormous amount of anxiety among the Venezuelan population about getting a vaccine. Of course, there's a black market, and if you have $450, you can probably get a shot, but you're taking a risk. What kind of a vaccine are you getting? Has it been properly stored? You know, is it real? Those kinds of things. So what we witnessed at the largest vaccination site in the country were lineups. I mean, lineups hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of people long. One lineup had people with mobile phones. They had received a notification from the government that effectively their number had come up and that they should go to such and such a destination. And if they're lucky, they would be admitted and get a shot that day. The other lineup were the people who were just hoping that by showing up, they might actually persuade the authorities to let them in. And these were largely people in their 70s and 80s, old people, frail people who didn't have mobile phones and so weren't registered as part of the national vaccination program. And truly, they were desperate.
Eric Schatzker visited Caracas last week. He's the editor at large for Bloomberg TV, and he joins us now. Welcome, Eric.
Tanya, hi. Good to be with you.
Yes, great to have you. A quick reminder for people, the U.S. has actually been imposing sanctions on Venezuela for over 15 years now for human rights abuses and corruption. And we know the Trump administration expanded those economic sanctions. Can you describe for us the impact of these sanctions today?
It's pretty clear, Tanya, when you walk around Caracas or go to any other part of Venezuela, that American foreign policy is having a dramatic impact on the country's economy. Venezuela used to be one of the world's largest oil producers, and the U.S. sanctions effectively bar Venezuela from selling its oil abroad. And so tens of billions of dollars of export revenue have disappeared. And the Venezuelan economy over the course of the past 8 years has contracted by about 80%. That is the worst depression in modern history. Now, to be sure, some of that is on the Venezuelans themselves, on the Maduro government and on the Chavez government that preceded it. They pursued a policy of nationalization, price controls, subsidies, all kinds of things out of the so-called neo-Marxist playbook. And they too had a depressive impact on Venezuelan economic growth. But what you see right now is that without the export revenue, without access to foreign capital markets, Venezuela is unbelievably squeezed. And people are living, many, many millions of people are living on a monthly salary of just $3. They get handouts from the government, but you can imagine, do the math yourself, you know, what kind of a life you can lead on an income that small.
Eric, I'm struck by this number. Something like 5 million people have left Venezuela. It's one of the largest mass migrations in the world. You were in Caracas last week. What struck you most about the situation there?
The city feels depopulated. There are abandoned buildings. The legendary traffic that snarled Caracas is almost no longer. You can really feel the impact of this mass migration. A fifth of the population has fled to escape hardship and, in some cases, political oppression. And on the ground, you can really feel it.
Well, Eric, you actually spoke with President Maduro, and during the interview, he actually asked President Biden to lift sanctions. And the administration actually responded. What did they say?
Well, the administration has no intention of lifting the sanctions unilaterally right now because they're in place for a reason. Even if it was the Trump administration that put these harsh sanctions in place, there's no question that the United States has issues with the way Venezuela is being managed, with political oppression, with the lack of free and fair elections, with corruption, with drug trafficking, with human rights abuses. And so there's going to have to be some movement from both sides if an agreement is to exist. What Maduro was signaling is that he's ready to negotiate. He wants to talk. The Trump administration pursued a policy of regime change. The Biden administration has said its policy is free and fair elections. Those two policies may achieve the same result, but they get there in very different ways. And that's why Maduro feels a sense of perhaps optimism, that there's potential for progress in what has up to now, for the past 4 years, been a stalemate.
Let's talk a little bit about Maduro's power. It's still in dispute. The international community called his 2019 win illegitimate. The Trump and now Biden administration says that as well. They recognize opposition leader Juan Guaido. How is this situation playing out there in Venezuela?
There's no question that Maduro's power is unchallenged locally. Juan Guaido is the Speaker of the National Assembly, and as a result, he was recognized by the United States and other governments as Venezuela's, let's call it, legitimate leader. But in Venezuela itself, the opposition is politically fragmented, and Guaido has popular support that you can measure in the teens, maybe 20%. But there are other opposition leaders who command support as well. And as a result, he does not speak for everyone who opposes the Maduro regime. And until the opposition gets itself together, if you will, and chooses a single representative and speaks with one voice, that's going to remain the case. So externally, he has, I guess, profile and maybe influence, internally, much less so.
Mm. You also spoke with Guaido. What does he think a path forward will look like between the U.S. and Venezuela?
Let's not forget that Juan Guaido supported the U.S. sanctions. He believed, as Donald Trump and his administration believed, that they would precipitate regime change, that they would foment a popular uprising or perhaps even a military coup. And that didn't happen. Donald Trump is gone, and Nicolas Maduro is still in the Miraflores Palace, as he told me. And so Guaido's position has had to shift. While he still supports the sanctions, he's now calling for free and fair elections and says that he's willing to negotiate. The difference between him and other leaders of the opposition is that he wants an all or nothing deal. In other words, a free and fair election, and only then should the United States lift the sanctions. And other leaders, such as Enrique Capriles, who is more moderate in his posture, says that these discussions should be incremental and that each side should be willing to make compromises along the way. What form those compromises take in the end remains unclear, because to date, very few have been made. But that's the way he sees it.
Well, do you expect anything to come out of these meetings that we're hearing about that are expected to happen in Washington with the opposition? What is the Biden administration prepared to do to help this situation?
It's not clear, and I don't expect a ton to come out of these meetings. It seems, from my point of view, for what it's worth, that Juan Guaido and his associates are trying to assert whatever power they have. Again, remember that internally, they don't have as much power as they appear to have externally. And it's a bit of a political power play among the Venezuelan opposition. For anything to really happen with respect to the sanctions, the United States government is going to have to see some form of concession on the part of the Maduro government. Does it need to be free and fair elections, or might he be willing to trade some other things? He's already done a few, and I'll explain. He allowed the World Food Program to come into Venezuela after years of resistance. He gave the political opposition two seats on Venezuela's five-seat National Election Commission, something it hasn't had for an awfully long time. And I should add, as a matter of fact, he released six CITGO executives to house arrest from prison. And so it demonstrates a willingness to compromise on some level, but thus far it hasn't been enough to prompt the U.S. government to lift the sanctions one iota.
Eric Schatzker is editor-at-large at Bloomberg TV. Eric, thank you so much for this update.
It's my pleasure.
Much to the relief of parents and kids, summer camps are back in business. Last year was just dismal for would-be campers who were shut out by the pandemic. But this year, this summer, break out the mosquito repellent. Tom Rosenberg is president and CEO of the American Camp Association. Tom, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Excited to be with you.
We're glad to have you, and we are a little ways into the camp season now, depending on where you live in the country. So how would you say things are going so far? What's the outlook?
Things are shaping up quite nicely, Peter. It's an exciting summer. After a disrupted summer last year and a disrupted school year, kids are going to be able to be outside and having fun with their friends. We're giving them a chance to regain some of that lost humanity.
Yeah. Well, I think when you use the term disrupted, it's a little bit of an understatement, right? I mean, how do you hope this summer stacks up to, I'll say, the horror that was 2020 for your industry and for others?
The past 16 months have been very difficult for all of us, and but most of all for our kids, where they've experienced not just academic learning loss, but social and emotional disconnection, social and emotional learning loss. This summer, everyone is trying to get involved in some kind of camp or summer learning program.
Right. People would be, kids and parents, probably very eager to get out of the house, to have something to do. How many camps are open this summer, especially if you were to compare it to what it was like last year?
Pre-COVID, we were serving about 26 million school-aged children with about 1.2 million seasonal counseling staff. And last summer, you know, only 18% of overnight camps operated and only 60% of day camps operated. This summer, the vast majority of camps serving typical kids will be open and operating, although not at scale because capacity is a bit reduced in order to operate safely in COVID.
Yeah. So that is really great news. But I bet parents and campers probably still have a lot of questions and maybe some concerns about safety or COVID protocols. I mean, some kids are going to be away from home for the first time in a very long time after a very troubling year or so. Are camps seeing more anxiety amongst families than usual? How are you coping with that?
Absolutely. Even last summer, we were seeing campers out of shape, wired pretty tight emotionally, maybe even more homesick than normal. And so camps really adjusted their schedules to allow more time for kids to be together and talk, time for stretching, exercising, kind of getting back into their bodies, if you will. Parents really need to understand how camp fits the needs of their individual kids. This summer, especially in addition to that, they want to dial in on what are the COVID protocols that are being employed by the camp. Most of the kids who are going to camp are not 12 and older, right? And so they are, you know, still unvaccinated.
Yeah. So how are you handling that?
Last summer, we were able to convene a great deal of research around the operational strategies that were employed in camps across the country. And what we found was that science and research really demonstrates that camps that have implemented this strict layered mitigation strategies like masking, cohorting, physical distancing, and like maintaining adapted facilities, they were successful in operating. We did a research study at the end of last summer where out of 90,000 participants in the study, only 102 had a confirmed COVID case, basically 0.1% of camp participants. This summer so far, I think I've seen one media report of a small outbreak during a staff training at a camp, but on the whole, so far, it's feeling pretty positive.
Did you just knock on something there?
I did. It was metal, though.
Well, we hope it works. Kids 12 and older can get vaccinated with the Pfizer shot. Is that something that camps are considering requiring?
A lot of camps are encouraging parents and campers to speak with their pediatricians about becoming fully vaccinated. They're also encouraging their staff members to become fully vaccinated. We also have much more widely available testing. Particularly overnight camps are employing, you know, a pre-camp test and a test when you arrive at camp, plus several tests after you arrive at camp, to really create a really solid bubble of hopefully a very healthy community. And if there is a camper or staff person in a cohort who is symptomatic, typically that whole cohort will be quarantined. But in this case, if they are a fully vaccinated individual, they'll be able to continue camp.
I heard you mention the staff there. Now, we've been hearing over and over and over again that workers across the economy, tough to come by these days. What are you seeing, especially with your seasonal workers who have traditionally come from overseas?
We're really seeing a tremendous impact on the capacity of the field of camp to be able to serve every interested young person because of the seasonal employment shortage. And you mentioned cultural exchange visitors. You know, each summer, gosh, since 1961, there have been as many as 31,000 cultural exchange visitors coming from all sorts of different countries. This year, due to the executive proclamation that President Trump enacted in his term, which did not expire until March, there has been a tremendously difficult process to get those international cultural exchange visitors over to the United States. So this has exacerbated the seasonal employment shortage that we've been in, affected by already here in the U.S.
Tom Rosenberg is president and CEO of the American Camp Association. We wish you the best of luck this summer. The kids need it. The parents need it. Your staff need it. So thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, Peter. It's a great pleasure to talk to you.
Here and Now, a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.